is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
U.S. President Joe Biden on Monday, 1st of November, attempted to reinvigorate global commitments to fight climate change by pledging that the U.S. is not only back at the table, but hopefully leading by the power of our example at a conference in Glasgow, Scotland. Joe Biden also apologized for former President Donald Trump's withdrawal of the United States from the Paris Climate Accord. The article you're about to hear has been written by Cecilia Smith-Schoenwalder, a journalist writing about health and the environment for U.S. News and World Report. The piece is titled, Biden Apologizes for Trump's Withdrawal of the U.S. from the Paris Agreement on Climate Change. U.S. President Joe Biden on Monday, 1st of November, attempted to reinvigorate global commitments to fight climate change by pledging that the United States is not only back at the table, but hopefully leading by the power of our example at a conference in Glasgow, Scotland. Joe Biden also apologized for former President Donald Trump's withdrawal of the United States from the Paris Climate Accord. I know it hasn't been the case, and that's why my administration is working overtime to show that our climate commitment is action and not words, Biden said at the Global Climate Change Summit in Glasgow, known as COP26, likely referencing his predecessor, Donald Trump. He also apologized for Donald Trump's removal of the United States from the Paris Agreement on Climate Change, which Biden recommended to on his first day in office. I guess I shouldn't apologize, but I do apologize for the fact that United States in the last administration pulled out of the Paris Accords, and put us sort of behind the eight ball, Biden said. He also noted that given the U.S. history of actions such as deforestation that have sped up climate change, the nation has an obligation to act now. Specifically, the United States and other nations need to step up financing for other countries that have not had the opportunity to do as much damage as we have had, he said. Despite his efforts to lead by example, Joe Biden has been struggling to get countries like Russia and China to come to the table to make stronger climate pledges. On Sunday, he expressed disappointment to reporters over the nation's lack of new commitments to handle climate change. The Biden administration on Monday released its long-term strategy to achieve a net-zero economy by 2050. His administration has also committed to halving greenhouse gas emissions by 2030. Biden ran over his time limit at both of his appearances on Monday at the summit, but Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who is hosting the event, made a case for allowing the president to take his time. Everybody will understand the huge importance of the United States in helping the world to take action and show solidarity, Boris Johnson said. The goal of the summit is to encourage governments to commit to actions that limit global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. However, the United Nations-appointed Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change wrote in a report in August of this year that the global temperatures have already jumped 1.1 degrees Celsius since the 19th century to reach their highest level in over 100,000 years. Climate experts agree that immensely more action is needed for there to be a chance at curbing rising temperatures to 1.5 degrees Celsius. If achieved in full and on time, already announced pledges will start to bend the global emissions curve down, the International Energy Agency IEA wrote in a commentary ahead of the summit. But the pledges to date, even if fully achieved, fall well short of what is required to bring global energy-related carbon dioxide emissions to net zero by 2050 and give the world an even chance of limiting the global temperature rise to 1.5 degrees Celsius. Concerns over climate inaction have been growing in response to how the COVID-19 pandemic has played out. The pandemic has taught us that national solutions to global problems do not work, Barbados's Prime Minister Mia Mottley said at the summit in Glasgow. UN Secretary-General Antonio Guterres added that the recent climate action announcements might give the impression that we are on track to turn things around, but he said, this is an illusion.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, and Iceland.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
As the World War II was dragging on, the United States tested the first ever nuclear bomb in a desert in New Mexico on July 16, 1945. The test, codenamed Trinity, plunged humanity into the so-called atomic age. The U.S. holds another record as well. They are the first nation to ever use an atomic weapon in combat. On August 6, 1945, the U.S. dropped the world's first deployed atomic bomb over the Japanese city of Hiroshima. The explosion instantly killed an estimated 80,000 people, while tens of thousands lost their lives later due to the radiation exposure. 3 days later, a second atomic bomb was dropped on Nagasaki, killing an estimated 40,000 people there. In fact, the U.S. is the only country in history to have cold-bloodedly used this particular sort of weapon of mass destruction ever. Not once, but twice. The world's nuclear-armed states possess a combined total of approximately 13,000 nuclear warheads. The U.S., along with Russia, own over 90% of the world's total nuclear arsenal. Washington and Moscow signed the Non-Proliferation Agreement of New START on 8th of April 2010 in Prague, and later extended it for 5 years in January 2021. The treaty caps each country at 1,550 strategic deployed warheads. Today, the United States deploys over 1,300 strategic warheads on several hundred bombers and missiles. It is also estimated to have approximately 3,800 stockpiled warheads and 1,750 retired warheads awaiting dismantlement, for a total of 5,550 warheads as of early 2021. While Washington may have reduced its nuclear arsenal in size, in fact, it's increasing the destructiveness of its weapons by development of sophisticated electronic sensors and fuses at the cost of billions of dollars to have more advanced nuclear warheads. The U.S. has time and again stated that it is committed to the New START Treaty until Russia is. However, it seems Washington is not completely committed to the agreement. On one hand, it is reducing the number of its nuclear warheads. On the other, it produces more lethal, destructive bombs with higher precision. The U.S. is expected to release its latest nuclear posture review by the end of this year. U.S. allies are concerned over a proposed change to Washington's long-standing policy on using nuclear weapons. The U.S. is reportedly considering putting a limit on the use of nuclear weapons, such as announcing a no first use of nuclear weapons or declaration of a sole purpose. That means Washington will only use nuclear weapons to respond to nuclear attacks. Hence, the U.S. allies, including the U.K., Germany, France, Japan, and Australia, are reportedly lobbying the Joe Biden administration to abandon the policy of a strategic ambiguity on using nuclear weapons. They believe this decision will make them more prone to possible threats from China and Russia. Obviously, this shows the anti-nuclear doctrine the U.S. allies have been advocating is totally deceitful. They are simply pursuing unilateral nuclear security as they want to expand their own right to use nuclear weapons. But they have tried every possible means to take away the right of using nuclear power from other countries, such as Iran. Restrictions on using nuclear weapons create constructive opportunities for global security. But does Biden have the courage to take real steps to do so? The group was formed to address major issues related to global economy. It is composed of world's largest economies, including Brazil, Britain, China, Germany, India, and the US, among others. These member countries account for 80% of the global GDP, 75% of global trade, and 60% of the world population. But the G20 has been criticized for its limited membership, particularly for its underrepresentation of African countries. There are also disputes over the legitimacy of the G20 and criticisms of its organization and its declarations. The group has failed to address its previous promises, like inequality, social justice, poverty, capitalism, and unemployment. Therefore, the summits are often met with protests, especially by anti-globalization groups. This year, the G20 annual summit gathered the international leaders of the world's biggest economies for a two-day meeting under the chairmanship of Italy in Rome. The summit was the first in-person meeting in over a year after the 2020 summit was virtual due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Still, Chinese President Xi Jinping and Russian President Vladimir Putin participated in the summit virtually. The member states addressed several global challenges, such as the pandemic, climate change, spiking energy prices, supply chain disruptions, and so forth. The bloc is under pressure to make headway on tackling global warming. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres warned G20 leaders to show more action to overcome mistrust to advance climate goals. These nations account for roughly 80% of the global greenhouse gas emissions. This year's event comes amid protests at inaction to address the problem of climate change. On Friday, thousands of school students staged a rally calling on the G20 summit to deal with the crisis. Other groups, including the charity Oxfam, also held a flash mob in Rome. They demanded world leaders end global inequality of access to coronavirus vaccines and treatment. In fact, wealthy nations such as the US have implemented a Me First policy by stockpiling vaccine doses and offering booster shots, while many poor countries are still waiting to receive their first COVID jabs.
Well, they have failed to end inequality, to end poverty, and to slow and change the trajectory of climate change, because the leaders of these governments simply don't care about those things.
After Washington imposed fresh sanctions against Iran, the United States and the European signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal have urged Iran to return to the talks soon to avoid what they call a dangerous escalation. In a joint statement following the G20 summit, US President Joe Biden, German Chancellor Angela Merkel, French President Emmanuel Macron, and British Prime Minister Boris Johnson have called on Iran to, quote, change course. That's a reference to Iran's remedial moves on its nuclear commitments. Tehran stood by its obligations for a whole year, but it started cutting back on them in response to the U.S. abandonment of the deal in 2018 and the failure of the European parties to keep their side of the agreement. Iran says it's ready to restart negotiations in late November, but wants to see the verifiable removal of sanctions as an outcome of the talks. Washington, on the other hand, targeted Tehran's drone program with a new set of sanctions on Friday, a move which Iran says is at odds with the White House claims of wishing to rejoin the agreement.
They will justify it by saying that Iran wouldn't come back to the bargaining table. They will not look at the fact that it was the United States that withdrew, and the United States that must make the first major moves to resurrect this agreement. But this summit is certainly a place where many, many discussions occur, many issues are on the table to be resolved. The situation with U.S. violation of JCPOA is certainly one of them, but it is being ignored.
Iran has been under the most intense scrutiny and inspection by the IAEA than any country in the world. Meanwhile, Tehran has time and again stated that its nuclear program is peaceful and it was among the first nations to sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Tehran's stance is clear: effective removal of anti-Iran sanctions and the normalization of economic and trade ties with the country. Iran requires guarantees that the other parties to the 2015 nuclear deal will not break their promises once again.
Sudan's transition to democracy has been disrupted by yet another coup. Last week, head of Sudan's ruling council, Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, announced a dissolution of the country's transitional government and declared a state of emergency. He cited political infighting for the decision, adding that the move was made to avoid a civil war. The military rounded up Sudan's top officials, including Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok.
This government, or this government that Burhan has overthrown, was a government that came about on the basis of an agreement that there would not be any elections, that there would not be a democratic transition. It's important to stress that when al-Bashir fell, the reason why the civilian parties were happy to enter into an agreement with the army is because they felt that if they went to elections, the Sudanese people would reject them and vote for Islamic-leaning parties, i.e. vote for the Islamists in a different form from al-Bashir. And therefore, these leftist parties that are the civilian parties that Burhan has overthrown, they were happy to prevent elections. They were happy to take 67% of parliament unelected. They were happy to agree to an extended transition period in order to avoid giving people a say in what they wanted.
Nearly a dozen protesters were killed in the demonstrations that ensued, but that didn't deter the Sudanese from calling for mass protests against the coup. General Burhan has expressed hope that a new prime minister would be chosen to form a government within a week. He also suggested that the ousted prime minister has been offered a chance to return to his position and select a new cabinet. The next government is expected to stay in power until an election in 2023. The protesters say the military isn't serious about handing over power to civilians, describing the council as an extension of the old regime. The coup in Sudan drew condemnation from the international community, with the United Nations Security Council adopting a unanimous declaration calling on the junta to restore the civilian government. The World Bank has halted financial aid to the African country, while the African Union suspended Sudan's membership in the bloc. Iran has also denounced the coup, saying the undemocratic removal of a part of the ruling system in the African country disregards the demands of the Sudanese people. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh raised the possibility of foreign interference in what led to the ouster of Sudan's civilian rulers. He referred to reactions from Israel, where he said some are openly expressing delight in the aftermath of the recent coup. That doesn't come as a surprise, as Sudan normalized ties with the regime last year under an agreement brokered by the administration of former U.S. President Donald Trump. Sudan's top brass have also maintained good relationships with the United Arab Emirates, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia, but experts believe that seemingly close ties might not last long.
It's important to remember that the UAE are also allies with the leftist parties in Sudan. The UAE was part of brokering the agreement between the leftist parties and the army, and also the UAE is hesitant with regards to the army that Abdel Fattah Burhan leads, in that even if it is perhaps comfortable with Abdel Fattah Burhan, the army is still seen to be predominantly Islamist, the army is still seen to be predominantly conservative, the army is still predominantly against normalization of ties with Israel. Even if Abdel Fattah Burhan himself has been pushing normalization of ties with Israel, there is a worry in the UAE and in Egypt that if the army becomes stronger in Sudan once more, then Abdel Fattah Burhan will not last long, and it may well be that they go back to the more conservative trends that al-Bashir represented. And this is why it's important to stress that it is not a given that the UAE, Saudi, and Egypt will support this coup. It's not a given that they are lobbying on behalf of Abdel Fattah Burhan.
But it appears that the Sudanese are determined to continue their protests, as they have done in the past few years, until their demands are met.
Saudi Arabia and its ally, the United Arab Emirates, have been defying international calls for an end to their disastrous war in Yemen. The destructive military campaign that's triggered the world's worst humanitarian crisis has been ongoing since March 2015. Tens of thousands of people, most of them civilians, have been killed in airstrikes or by deadly diseases or hunger. Millions have been displaced. Yemen's economy is in tatters, and international aid can hardly make its way to those in severe need because of a Saudi blockade. Despite untold human suffering, Saudis and Emiratis keep pounding Yemen in a war that has achieved none of its stated goals. And the aggressors are absolutely intolerant of any form of criticism of what they are doing in Yemen. That was on full display this week as criticism of the devastating war by a Lebanese minister infuriated the kingdom and its allies, triggering angry reactions from them. Saudi Arabia and most members of the Saudi-led Persian Gulf Cooperation Council, namely the UAE, Bahrain, and Kuwait, summoned Lebanese ambassadors to their capitals. This after Lebanese Information Minister George Kordai called for an end to the futile military campaign against Yemen. The Saudi Foreign Ministry said in a statement that it handed the ambassador a memorandum protesting against the minister's, quote, offensive remarks.
They know they're in the wrong. They feel guilty. And they also feel a sense of impunity. They feel that no one should criticize them because they've got lots of money and other people don't. So, it's a very sensitive subject for them. What they're doing in Yemen is, if any other country had done it, they would have been condemned much more fiercely and much sooner by the other countries in the region and the world. But the Saudis think that they have a lock on the Arab world and the Islamic world and much of the Western world, so they really don't understand criticism.
The Lebanese information minister said in the interview that the Saudi-led forces are pounding homes, villages, funerals, and weddings. Kordai also said that he believes that the popular Ansarullah forces are defending themselves against an external aggression. The Lebanese information minister is now finding himself at the center of a political storm for speaking his mind. This is because Lebanon has been trying to improve ties with Persian Gulf Arab states. Prime Minister Najib Mikati seems to be in damage control mode now. He said the interview was recorded before his cabinet was formed and was a personal opinion rather than official policy. The information minister, who is under pressure for his remarks against the devastating war in Yemen, says he stated his position with love as a human who feels Arab suffering. The humanitarian situation in Yemen is apocalyptic. The unbearable suffering of civilians in Yemen has been ongoing for several years. But no measure has been taken against the war, which has also been militarily backed by Western allies of Saudi Arabia. The war in Yemen had been planned to quickly achieve its goals, like reinstating former President Abdurrabu Mansour Hadi, who is a Saudi ally. But it has proved to be an embarrassing failure. Despite this, the invaders remain defiant and are not changing course. This has taken a heavy toll on Yemen's infrastructure and civilian population. Faced with international inaction, Yemenis have been left with no other option than retaliatory missile and drone attacks against Saudi targets.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In many ways, the immigration crisis is the latest chapter in a rolling history of the U.S. interventionism. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jonathan N. G. Ryder. This article is published under the heading Haiti's Humanitarian Crisis Reveals Human Costs of U.S. Interventionism. Stay tuned for more. This September, U.S. Border Patrol agents violently seized Haitian refugees along the Rio Grande, attracting fierce criticism and international attention. Officers on horseback trotted through families, wielded their reins as whips, and chased migrants carrying their meager possessions in plastic bags. After scandalizing public opinion, President Joe Biden deemed the operation outrageous and promised that the border agents will pay. Yet, behind the scenes, his administration has swiftly deported thousands of Haitians. Authorities frequently exploit Title 42 of the Public Health Services Law to expel refugees seeking asylum. "We're doing this out of a public health need," claims U.S. Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas, adding it is not an immigration policy, but in practice, the legal subterfuge has allowed Customs and Border Protection, CBP, to turn historic numbers of migrants away. Recently, the U.S. Special Envoy to Haiti, Daniel Foote, resigned in protest, denouncing the inhumane, counterproductive policy. Since then, humanitarian crisis has only deepened. Blocked from reaching the U.S., Haitians now constitute the second largest group seeking protection in Mexico. For most, the border is simply the latest stretch in a grueling continental odyssey. Many traveled across Latin America on swollen ankles, braved discrimination, and survived unspeakable adversity. And now they wait. Observers routinely cite Haiti's recent earthquake, grinding poverty and political upheaval for the immigration crisis, but neglect an essential factor. While U.S. officials jealously guard the Texas border, they have not hesitated to violate Haiti's. In many ways, the immigration crisis is the latest chapter in a rolling history of U.S. interventionism. For over a century, the United States has decisively shaped Haitian affairs. Fearing political instability, Woodrow Wilson sent Marines in 1914 to relocate the Haitian National Bank's holdings to New York. A year later, they invaded Haiti to protect the investments of Western creditors, initiating a two-decade occupation that entailed the ruthless suppression of dissent and wholesale transfer of assets to U.S. corporations. Ultimately, the U.S. left a legacy of militarism, saddling the island with a bloated army that repeatedly intervened in politics. Haitian legislators approved the law reorganizing the military under U.S. pressure. The constabulary shall be organized and officiated by Americans, the act crisply stated. Racism inflamed fears of political instability, ostensibly justifying U.S. intervention, and indelibly shaped the occupation. Commander Smedley Butler waxed paternal, later claiming that occupiers were trustees of a huge estate that belonged to miners. As Butler filled the army with Haitian recruits, he called his subordinates little chocolate soldiers and elsewhere described himself as the chief of police force. The U.S. Marines withdrew in 1934, but the Haitian military continued exerting preponderant influence over island politics. In 1957, the army swept François Dolivre, into office through rigged elections. Until 1986, the Dolliver family retained power by creating a personal paramilitary force and turning the army into a privileged caste. As a former political prisoner Robert Duval observed, traditionally the army of Haiti was always the one that gave and took political power. U.S. military intervention returned after Jean Bertrand Aristide became president in 1991. The Salesian priest secured national stature during the dwindling days of the Dolivar dictatorship for his advocacy for the poor. Yet his liberation theology, reformist agenda, and critical independence alarmed the U.S., which backed his removal in September 1991. After Aristide returned to power in 1994, the Clinton administration slipped army and paramilitary records out of the country in order to shield officers from prosecution. The next year, Haiti dissolved its military, yet in early 2004, former officers poised to again oust Aristide. Their leaders included Guy Philippe, who received training from U.S. Special Forces, and Louis Jodl Chamblain, a retired officer who previously led a CIA-backed death squad. Their main goal was to re-establish the military. The Bush administration finished the coup with crude finesse. In February 24, a delegation of U.S. diplomats and troops arrived at Aristide's house. They warned him that rebels were coming and would slaughter his family unless he immediately boarded a U.S. chartered plane. Remarkably, the U.S. delegation refused to protect Aristide despite its air of authority and abundant arms. They had not only the force of the embassy but the Marines with them, Congresswoman Maxine Waters explained, adding, they made clear that he had to go now or he would be killed. Indeed, the U.S. embassy obstructed his own security detail. After hastily ushering Aristide to the airport, the delegation refused to let him board without tendering a letter of resignation. The U.S. Navy SEAL escort then held him incommunicado for nearly 24 hours, denying him access to a telephone and spreading him out of the country. Aristide called the drama a modern-day kidnapping. His overthrow signaled another turn in the spiral of militarism. While the U.S. military mission consummated the coup, the Bush administration promoted the occupation of the island. 2 months later, it spearheaded the U.S. stabilization mission in Haiti, a formidable force of 9,000 blue helmets. The first independent country in Latin America became the only country in the hemisphere under foreign occupation. While militarizing Haiti's political crisis, the United States of America supported the ruling class that previously identified with the Dolivar dictatorship and bitterly resented Aristide, and both mobilized to prevent his return. According to a secret cable, Chief Edmund Mullet of MINUSTAH urged U.S. legal action against Aristide to prevent the former president from gaining more traction with the Haitian population and returning. Former U.S. Ambassador James Foley agreed in a telegram with the terse titled, Aristide Movement Must Be Stopped. As leftists rode the pink tide into office across Latin America, the Bush and Obama administrations deemed the Red Priest a threat to the island's pliant ruling class and neoliberalism. Privately, a special U.S. team prepared a dossier on Aristide, scouring his past for criminal activities to sully his reputation. And this summer, the two histories of interventionism intertwined. On July 7th, a band of mercenaries assassinated President Moi of Haiti. Most were veterans of Plan Colombia, and at least seven had received training from the United States of America. Their contractor, CTU Security, is a U.S. firm owned by Antonio Intrigo, a friend of Colombian President and Uribe protege, Ivan Duque. One leader, Captain German River Garcia, recalled their chilling orders. Everyone had to be killed, the police, the prison security, everything we encountered in the house. Another participant explained that there could be no witness. Following the assassination, Haitian Prime Minister Claude Joseph requested the U.S. and the U.N. send troops, eliciting widespread opposition. An organization representing retired military officials encouraged Haitians to reject the humiliation of foreign intervention. Yet, on August 14th, another earthquake gripped Haiti. In response, the U.S. sent Marines. They brought the USS Arlington, MH-60 Seahawk helicopters, P-8A Poseidon planes, and other military equipment, prompting observers to doubt their humanitarian mission. The cycle of crisis in Haiti and Colombia reveals that interventionism is not simply an event by a system. Incredibly, the United States Southern Command both trains Colombian troops and oversees humanitarian aid in Haiti. As the situation deteriorates, Haitians have sought refuge in the U.S. No destination on earth is more attractive for a Haitian. The Island Daily Law Nova Steel reports, adding, yet the refugees along the Texas border all think that the USA is largely responsible for their hardship and the sad state of their country. The latest chapter in the history of U.S. interventionism is neither tragedy nor farce, but defies literary convention. And yet the immigration crisis is cruelly poetic. Haitians are fleeing the violence of interventionism by running to its source.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
September 2nd, 2021. On the occasion of the National Government Week, President Raisi and the cabinet members met with Imam Khamenei in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya during the first days after the formation of the 30th administration.
There is another quotation from the Commander of the Faithful, alayhi salam, in his decree to Malik Ashtar. He says, avoid showing the existence of obligation on your subjects for having done good to them or praising your own actions. First of all, you should not think that the people are obliged to thank you for what you have done. And secondly, you should not exaggerate about what you have done, or making promises and then breaking them. This means making promises and then failing to honour them. Imam Ali alayhi salam warns Malik Ashtar not to act like this. And this is a very important point. Of course, then sometimes you make a promise, but later on you see that there is no possibility to fulfill it. For example, there might be a natural problem. It is all right. You should explain this to the people, saying that although you've made this promise, a certain problem arose which prevented you from fulfilling it, and ask for their forgiveness. This is another case of speaking to the people. This is another example of popularity, as explained before.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
However, generally speaking, you should be careful about the promises that you make. You should impose a deadline for your promises. You should estimate the time that it will take to carry out a task and set a deadline for it, and then you must follow it meticulously. I have said many times among executive officials that we have no shortage of rules and regulations. We have an abundance of laws, projects, and rules and regulations. What we lack is serious follow-up. This is another point. It is very important for the administration to have solidarity, power, and mastery. The solidarity of the administration means that executive officials should not say contradictory things. If one official says something and another says the opposite thing, the people's minds and public opinion will change unfavorably. There should be solidarity both in words and action. The affairs of a sector might be interrelated with many other sectors. Your agricultural sector is naturally connected with a few other sectors. There should be cooperation so that the task in hand will be accomplished properly.
About you, IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website,
www.parstoday.com/en.
یوسف جلالی تهران
اروپا شاوید گازا
جروم هیوز بروسلز
سعید پرزا لندن
راشا سگلم استانبول
سعید امین عالمی کابل
شهان بات ایندین ادمنستریت کشمیر
راوند دی ورلد وید ریپورترز.
Israeli envoys turn up of a UN human rights report on the crimes committed by Tel Aviv against Palestinians has sparked harsh criticism in the Gaza Strip. Palestinians described the move as a clear violation of their rights and considered it a green light to the Israeli forces to go further with their crimes against Palestinians.
What Israel's envoy did in the United Nations General Assembly serves as a slap in the face of those who always support Israel. The move exposed the true nature of Israel. Palestinians will keep defending their rights despite Israeli escalations.
Israel's envoy to the UN tore a copy of the annual report of the Human Rights Council, mimicking his predecessor. A UN committee held a special hearing at the General Assembly, and its president handed over the annual report to all member states, exposing the proto-Israeli crimes.
Human rights groups here condemn what the Israeli envoy did. They consider it as an obvious underestimation of all human rights and international laws. Israel considers itself above law. This is due to the international apathy towards Israel's previous crimes.
The UN report presented the findings of an investigative committee investigating the Israeli occupation's offensive on Gaza that killed hundreds of Palestinians, including women and children, as well as the regime's illegal settlement expansion in the West Bank. Palestinians here say by tearing up the UN human rights report, Israel underestimates all international standards, adding that this action reflects the arrogant nature of the regime. Palestinians called on the international community to make serious actions and hold Israel accountable for the crimes committed against Palestinian people. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Keep it in the ground. Protesters outside the venue of the UN Summit on Climate Change in Glasgow, giving world leaders a taste of what's to come in the coming days.
Protests have already gotten underway at the same time as the COP26, and the protesters have come here from far and wide to send one clear message to the world leaders. The time for talk is over. It is time for action, and we want it now.
A look at the most recent extreme weather events around the world supports that sense of urgency. From the bushfires in Australia, to the heat wave in icy Canada, to the forest fires in Turkey, and the floods that hit India and Europe earlier this year.
What more proof is needed, you know? And this is just the tip of the iceberg. It's only beginning now. It's going to get worse as the temperature goes up. So, you know, I'm here to say, hey, let's do something now.
Some of the world's biggest polluters, such as the U.S., China, and Europe, have set ambitious targets for the next 30 years to keep global warming in check. The protesters say setting goals is one thing, implementing them is another.
History has shown us that these world leaders are doing very little to actually reduce emissions. They're more interested in creating capitalist markets that save the economy as opposed to reduce emissions and save the planet. And it's going to be us putting pressure on them, not the solutions that they're negotiating inside.
It's already clear from the G20 summit in Italy that no matter what is agreed at COP26, global temperatures will continue to rise, affecting some communities more than others.
Failed climate policy that's existing right now that the world needs to know is on the backs of our indigenous peoples. It's going to devastate our food systems, our ricing systems, our culture.
6 years since the landmark Paris Climate Accord, and the stakes have never been higher. And these protesters